We come to the 11th chapter in Essays on the Gita. Works and Sacrifice. This had its first publication in the Arya on the 15th of June, 1917. It was styled as Part 1. Part 2, the subsequent month that closed out that year of the Arya, because remember it ran from August to July. When it came out in book form, he retitled as not Works and Sacrifice Part 2, but The Significance of Sacrifice. So we'll be getting to that. And then the chapter following was titled in the Arya, The Sacrifice and the Lord of the Sacrifice. And that was shortened when it came out in book form in 1923 to The Lord of the Sacrifice. Since we liked to touch upon some of the notes regarding this series as it appears in the Arya, I can tell you that in this June issue in 1917, the lead article was, of course, from the Life Divine series. It was The Eternal and the Individual. Then, of course, Essays on the Gita, Works and Sacrifice. Then, Synthesis of Yoga, The Planes of Our Existence. So we've seen that for Sri Aurobindo in his interpretation of the Gita, that yoga doesn't rest with the mere cessation of attachment to desire and to the forms of our experience and a quiescent state in which we're absolved from any connection to the universe, immersed in the sheer existence of the Atman or Brahman, however you want to call it. For Sri Aurobindo, works continue. In fact, you get a fuller realization of yoga if you do works in constant communion with the divine. So now we are really coming into how Sri Aurobindo's interpretation of the Gita begins to matter for India and for the world. Especially then, remember Sri Aurobindo was almost unique at this period in interpreting the Gita in a way that brought attention to what we must do in this hour, in this place. Sri Aurobindo had himself achieved this great silence, this extinction of ego, this absorption into the one reality in 1908. Sitting on the roof of a friend's house in Baroda. His only companion, a tantric yogi named Lele, who guided him a little. Sri Aurobindo had an almost instantaneous realization of what is Brahman and the cessation of thought. He said, because he was always modest, that it took 3 days for that silencing of his thought to become permanent. Again, modesty. Essentially, as soon as he looked and saw, he recognized reality, and the perturbations of the mind may have taken some time to settle down, but that's the nature of matter as it unwinds its energies. So did Sri Aurobindo simply rest in that state? No. He immediately returned to the field of action and resumed his political work for the liberation of India. This is not quietism. This is not absorption into a protected, carefully cultivated atmosphere that rebuffs all attempts to intrude from outside. Sri Aurobindo was a Karma Yogin. And in fact, you'll know that after he gave his famous Uttarpara speech on the 30th of May in 1909, and there's a wonderful photograph in which you can see Sri Aurobindo on the far right, and there's a slight smile, a sense of a deep felicity on his face. And he talks about the Sanatana Dharma, elemental to our study of the Gita, no? And of course, who was his companion all through his experiences in the Alipur jail, but Krishna himself, who led him, guided him, taught him, opened up the inner meaning of the Gita to him. So when Sri Aurobindo finishes this speech, almost the thing that he does next is to launch a journal, which is called Karma Yogin. The one who works in communion with the divine, who works in communion with the divine. And that ran for, oh, let's say, a number of months until he left Bengal for eventually Pondicherry. So, all of this just to say, Sri Aurobindo did not quit the world because he realized the divine. Sri Aurobindo took his realization back into the world. He understood fully what the Gita aimed at, and his life demonstrates that. If you mistake his relative isolation in Pondicherry, which was in part imposed upon him by the ongoing threat of Western imperialism, then you've misread his life. Because inside those rooms in Pondicherry, those rooms were a cave of tapasya, it's true, but they were also the field of the working out of the Dharma. He was constantly at work, writing, which is work, believe me, writing exacts tremendous energy to achieve. If you think that work only means laborious toil physically, then you misunderstand the nature of work. Work took physical form with him as well, because while he was perfecting himself psychologically, while he was lifting himself into the heights spiritually, he was also bringing it all back into a gauged impact in the body. He developed what we would call asanas, what we would call kriyas, to extend and develop the strength of the body, to make it more plastic so that larger and larger waves of pranic force and forces from higher than the planes of prana could visit his physique and find a proper abode there. So he was a worker for the divine at every level, not for what he could get out of it, not seeking satisfaction, personal profit or gain, or a sense of a greater felicity or deliverance from this thing or that thing. He lived in deep, constant peace and bliss. He needed nothing. He did this work as an offering to the divine. So we come to this chapter, Works and Sacrifice. remembering the context in which Sri Aurobindo lived. His work was his life, and his work encompassed knowledge, devotion, and yes, significant action. Let's begin reading this chapter, which is largely focused on the first few verses of chapter 3 in the Bhagavad Gita. Works and sacrifice. The yoga of the intelligent will and its culmination in the Brahmic status, which occupies all the close of the second chapter, contains the seed of much of the teaching of the Gita, its doctrine of desireless works, of equality, of the rejection of outward renunciation, of devotion to the divine. But as yet, all this is slight and obscure. What is most strongly emphasized as yet is the withdrawal of the will from the ordinary motive of human activities, desire, from man's normal temperament of the sense-seeking thought and will with its passions and ignorance, and from its customary habit of troubled, many-branching ideas and wishes to the desireless calm unity and passionless serenity of the Brahmic poise. So much Arjuna has understood. He is not unfamiliar with all this. It is the substance of the current teaching, which points man to the path of knowledge and to the renunciation of life and works as his way of perfection. The intelligence, withdrawing from sense and desire and human action and turning to the highest, to the one, to the actionless Purusha, to the immobile, to the featureless Brahman, that surely is the eternal seed of knowledge. There is no room here for works, since works belong to the ignorance. Action is the very opposite of knowledge. Its seed is desire, and its fruit is bondage. That is the orthodox philosophical doctrine. And Krishna seems quite to admit it when he says that works are far inferior to the yoga of the intelligence. Chapter 2, Shloka 49. And yet, works are insisted upon as part of the yoga, so that there seems to be in this teaching a radical inconsistency. And let's remember what radical means, please. Radical doesn't mean extreme. Radical means at its root, going back to the root. Sri Aurobindo uses English properly. A radical inconsistency. Not only so, for some kind of work, no doubt, may persist for a while, the minimum, the most inoffensive. But here is a work wholly inconsistent with knowledge, with serenity, and with the motionless peace of the self-delighted soul, a work terrible, even monstrous, a bloody strife, a ruthless battle, a giant massacre. Yes, we're at Kurukshetra, and Krishna is telling Arjuna, pick up your bow, kill the enemy. Yet, it is this that is enjoined, this that is sought to justify, that it is sought to justify by the teaching of inner peace and desireless equality and status in the Brahman. Here, then, is an unreconciled contradiction. Arjuna complains that he has been given a contradictory and confusing doctrine, not the clear, strenuously single road by which the human intelligence can move straight and trenchantly to the supreme good. That's 3.2, by the way. It is, in answer to this objection, that the Gita begins at once to develop more clearly its positive and imperative doctrine of works. The teacher first makes a distinction between the two means of salvation, on which in this world men can concentrate separately: the yoga of knowledge, the yoga of works. The one implying, 3-3, it is usually supposed, renunciation of works as an obstacle to salvation. The other, accepting works as a means of salvation. He does not yet insist strongly on any fusion of them, on any reconciliation of the thought that divides them, but begins by showing that the renunciation of the Sankhyas, the physical renunciation, sannyasa, is neither the only way nor at all the better way. Naishkarmya, a calm voidness from works, is no doubt that to which the soul, the Purusha, has to attain. For it is Prakriti which does the work, and the soul has to rise above involution in the activities of the being and attain to a free serenity and poise, watching over the operations of Prakriti, but not affected by them. Again, being seated above, Udasinavad Asino, as in 9:9 and 14:23. Sitting in, as one sits out. That, and not cessation of the works of Prakriti, is what is really meant by the soul's naishkarmya. Therefore, it is an error to think that by not engaging in any kind of action, this actionless state of the soul can be attained and enjoyed. Mere renunciation of works is not a sufficient, not even quite, a proper means for salvation. Not by abstention from works does a man enjoy actionless, nor by mere renunciation of works does he attain to his perfection, to siddhi, the accomplishment of the aims of his self-discipline by yoga. That's 3-4. By the way, we could also go to the close of the Gita, chapter 18:49, and Sri Aurobindo renders it like this: he whose intellect is unattached everywhere, who has subdued his self, from whom desire has disappeared, he, by renunciation, attains naishkarmya siddhim, the supreme state of freedom from action. So 3-4 and 18:49. But at least it must be one necessary means, indispensable, imperative, for how, if the works of Prakriti continue, can the soul help being involved in them? How can I fight, and yet in my soul not think or feel that I, the individual, am fighting, not desire victory, nor be inwardly touched by defeat? This is the teaching of the Sankhyas, that the intelligence of the man who engages in the activities of nature is entangled in egoism, ignorance, and desire, and therefore drawn to action. On the contrary, if the intelligence draws back, then the action must cease with the cessation of the desire and the ignorance. Remember, Sri Aurobindo will use the language of the Sankhya, but he is not endorsing that perspective here. This is not his view. Remember, he has extinguished the ego, and he continues to work, whether fighting for the transformation of India or fighting for the ultimate transformation of nature. Sri Aurobindo is fully engaged without ego. Back to his essay. Therefore, the giving up of life and works is a necessary part, an inevitable circumstance, and an indispensable last means of the movement to liberation. This objection of a current logic, it is not expressed by Arjuna, but it is in his mind, as the turn of his subsequent utterances shows, the teacher immediately anticipates. No, he says, such renunciation, far from being indispensable, is not even possible. Quote, for none stands, even for a moment, not doing work. Everyone is made to do action helplessly by the modes born of Prakriti. 3, 5. So the three gunas compel all to work. If you're here, you're working. The strong perception of the great cosmic action and the eternal activity and power of the cosmic energy, which was so much emphasized afterwards by the teaching of the tantric Shaktas, who even made Prakriti or Shakti superior to Purusha, is a very remarkable feature of the Gita. And the Shaktas appear within a few hundred years. We begin to see a lot of their work beginning to come into expression in India by, let's say, the 6th century CE, and then dominating for maybe 1,000 years or so. The actual thought and construction and operation of Indian spiritual and religious life. So very much, how do we do it? Although here, an undertone, it is still strong enough, coupled with what we might call the theistic and devotional elements of its thought, to bring in that activism which so strongly modifies in its scheme of yoga the quietistic tendencies of the old metaphysical Vedanta. Man, embodied in the natural world, cannot cease from action, not for a moment, not for a second. His very existence here is an action. The whole universe is an act of God. Mere living, even, is his movement. So, the rendering of the cosmic Purusha in art, the figure of Nataraj in sculpture, all point to a dynamic universe which is an expression constantly of the will of the divine, whether it is apparent to the divided, dualistic human mind or not. The world is a riddle to us because our intelligence and our insight is so small. If we will agree to converge our being, to yoke our being back to the divine, in thought and feeling, in love, and in communion of works, then we might know from identity what the divine knows constantly. Our physical life, its maintenance, its continuance is a journey, a pilgrimage of the body. Sharira yatra, and it means that literally. Sharira, body, yatra, pilgrimage. You're on a pilgrimage. So everything that you're doing has a spiritual destination, and every step that you take can be not simply an advance towards it, but a preparation for getting there. It can be an offering. It can be a measure of your inner progress matched to your outer step. That's 3-8, by the way. But even if a man could leave his body unmaintained, osios, if he could stand still always like a tree or sit inert like a stone, tishtati, that vegetable or material immobility would not save him from the hands of nature. He would not be liberated from her workings. This is 3-5, by the way. For it is not our physical movements and activities alone which are meant by works, by karma. Our mental existence also is a great complex action. It is even the greater and more important part of the works of the unresting energy, the subjective cause and determinant of the physical. So it is what we do in our minds that is ultimately our karma. That is a secret which is recognized first in India in the Upanishads and almost contemporaneously, 100 or 2 years later, by the Buddha, that the work that you do is not what chains you, it's your identification with the fruit of what you did, and only that is meaningful, which is intended. The inattentive stuff that goes on, the mechanical stuff that goes on with life, that's not what captures you. You don't need to worry about that. But what you should pay attention to is what you intend. And so you have to get deeply into yourself to understand your motivations at every level. It's an invitation to inner growth. We have gained nothing if we repress the effect, but retain the activity of the subjective cause. The objects of sense are only an occasion for our bondage. The mind's insistence on them is the means, the instrumental cause. So we can physically quit eating ice cream and be heroic in our poise of conquest. But if inwardly we're constantly eating ice cream in our mind, we have continued our slavery. The bondage has never ceased. The objects of sense are only an occasion for our bondage. The mind's insistence on them is the means, the instrumental cause. A man may control his organs of action and refuse to give them their natural play, but he has gained nothing if his mind continues to remember and dwell upon the objects of sense. Such a man has bewildered himself with false notions of self-discipline. He has not understood its object or its truth, nor the first principles of his subjective existence. Therefore, all his methods of self-discipline are false and null. And there's a footnote here. Let's read it. He writes, I cannot think that mithyachara means a hypocrite. How is a man a hypocrite who inflicts on himself so severe and complete a privation? He is mistaken and deluded. Vimuddhatma. And his achara, his formerly regulated method of self-discipline, is a false and vain method. This surely is all that the Gita means. And by the way, that's chapter 3, verses 6 and 7. Mithyachara has been typically translated as hypocrite when rendered in English. Franklin Edgerton did it. Swami Chidbhavananda, following somebody's lead, also renders it as hypocrite. But it is a matter of self-delusion. Vimuddha Atma, the self-deluded, is a very good point that Sri Aurobindo comes to. It's the words right in front of this expression, mithyachara. Therefore, all his methods of self-discipline are false and null. They don't lead anywhere because mistaken at the outset. The body's actions, even the mind's actions, are nothing in themselves, neither a bondage nor the first cause of bondage. What is vital is the mighty energy of nature, which will have her way and her play in her great field of mind and life and body. What is dangerous in her is the power of her three gunas, modes or qualities, to confuse and bewilder the intelligence and so obscure the soul. That, as we shall see later, is the whole crux of action and liberation for the Gita. Be free from obscuration and bewilderment by the three gunas, and action can continue, as it must continue. And even the largest, richest, or most enormous and violent action, it does not matter, for nothing then touches the Purusha. The soul has naishkarmya. Again, 3, 4. And I think this is a good place to put our bookmark, and we'll finish the chapter next time, I guess in early July. There's a section in Savitri, Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, and Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release, that I thought I might read to you from, which seems appropriate. I think we'd start on page 26. Let's begin about halfway down that page. In hands sustained by a transfiguring might, he caught up lightly like a giant's bow, left slumbering in a sealed and secret cave, the powers that sleep unused in man within. He made of miracle a normal act, and turned to a common part of divine works, magnificently natural at this height, efforts that would shatter the strength of mortal hearts, pursued in a royalty of mighty ease, aims too sublime for nature's daily will. The gifts of the Spirit crowding came to him. They were his life's pattern and his privilege. A pure perception lent its lucent joy. Its intimate vision waited not to think. It enveloped all nature in a single glance. It looked into the very self of things. Deceived no more by form, he saw the soul. In beings, it knew what lurked to them unknown. It seized the idea in mind, the wish in the heart. It plucked out from gray folds of secrecy the motives which from their own sight men hide. He felt the beating life in other men invade him with their happiness and their grief. Their love, their anger, their unspoken hopes entered in currents or in pouring waves into the immobile ocean of his calm. He heard the inspired sound of his own thoughts re-echoed in the vault of other minds. The world's thought streams traveled into his ken. His inner self grew near to others' selves and bore a kinship's weight, a common tie, yet stood untouched, king of itself, alone. A magical accord quickened and attuned to ethereal symphonies, the old earthy strings. It raised the servitors of mind and life to be happy partners in the soul's response. Tissue and nerve were turned to sensitive chords, records of luster and ecstasy. It made the body's means the spirit's acolyte. A heavenlier function with a finer mode lit with its grace man's outward earthliness. The soul's experience of its deeper sheaths no more slept drugged by matter's dominance. In the dead wall closing us from wider self into a secrecy of apparent sleep, the mystic tract beyond our waking thoughts, a door parted, built in by matter's force, releasing things unseized by earthly sense. A world unseen, unknown by outward mind, appeared in the silent spaces of the soul. He sat in secret chambers looking out into the luminous countries of the unborn, where all things dreamed by the mind are seen and true, and all that the life longs for is drawn close. He saw the perfect in their starry homes, wearing the glory of a deathless form, lain in the arms of the eternal's peace, wrapped in the heartbeats of God ecstasy. He lived in the mystic space where thought is born and will is nursed by an ethereal power and fed on the white milk of the eternal strengths till it grows into the likeness of a god. In the witness's occult rooms, with mind-built walls on hidden interiors, lurking passages opened the windows of the inner sight. He owned the house of undivided time. Well, namaste, Jai Ma.